mention of their names or even their numbers. Indeed, how does the abbess choose them? Where do they go after 10 years? I seek them, but they remain hidden. They are saints and martyrs, as venerated, as significant, as unknown as the omens themselves. I turned to the last page of the notebook, where a single line was written. But ever I wonder, what horrible thing do they hide behind their shrouds? 6. I whirled. Benji stood behind me, holding a cup of wine and a candle. My voice was an ugly rasp. Where am I? The Chiming Wood. This is Petula Hall, Maud's house. His eyes were wide. We arrived yesterday. You've been unconscious. Do you feel any better? His eyes fell to his desk, to the notebook, sprawled open upon it. I stabbed my finger over the final page. What is this? He didn't seem to understand. My grandfather's notebook. He's written about diviners. The bite marks in my neck seared with every word. You told me he hadn't. The king fiddled with his wine glass. Yes, well, what he wrote wasn't exactly relevant to taking up the... I came before him like a dark shadow. This was never about taking up the mantle for me, boy king. It was about finding my friends. He nodded so quickly, he looked like he was shaking. I thought you might not come with us if you knew what my grandfather had written, that no diviner had ever been heard from after her service at Ashling. I thought... He looked to his wine for courage, upending it into his mouth. I thought it would pain you. I put a hand to my bandaged neck. So, the king decides when I should bear pain and when I shouldn't, so long as it serves him best. I said it with the tastelessness it was due. Not so different from the abbess, are you? From an omen. Benji flinched. It sounds horrible when you put it like that. True things often do. Shoulders slumping, mouth struck down, the king looked helpless. I'm sorry, Six. It is very difficult for me, with all of Traum's opposing stories, to know what to say, or what is right. I usually ask Maud or Rory to tell me what to do, because most of the time, I simply don't know. I should have just been honest. His chin began to tremble. There is a very good chance we will not find your diviners. Dead. Your diviners are all dead. Because of Ashling's spring water. Because the omens crave it. And we have spent our service drowning in it. So when our 10 years are up, the abbess... But I couldn't say the rest. Where is my gargoyle? He is with Maud in the village. Pith, I'm sorry, Six. It's... Oh, you are... Benji's gaze lowered to my tunic. You're bleeding. I'm fine. We thought you were dead, you know. We got the oar off the platform before it sank, kicked the ardent oarsman's corpse for good measure. We pulled you out of the water, and Rory beat your chest, but we thought... Benji's voice was small, frayed. You should rest. I'll send for some fresh clothes. He left me the way he'd found me, alone, with the unbearable truth. I didn't go back to my room. I didn't know where I was going, but I went. Bare feet slapping against stone, I took to the stairs. When I reached the entry, the punctures in my neck swelled as I hauled open the great wood door. The stormy skies I'd known in the fervent peaks were gone. The Chiming Woods night was still, with blue heavens and a glowing moon that hung over a dense forest of birch trees. I limped away from Petula Hall, down the drive, until I stood at the edge of a vast wall of trees, slipped into the arms of the wood, and screamed. My feet couldn't take me where I needed to go, because my feet were bleeding. Just as well. I had nowhere to go. I tripped over rocks, roots, brambles, fell. I lay utterly still upon dirt, bleeding moon's blood, praying for a way to sink my teeth into earth and stone and flesh and rip Traum open until the entire world was a gaping wound. To wipe Ashling Cathedral from existence, obliterate the omens from lore, from memory, from the annals of time. I lay there and lay there, and my prayers weren't answered. Nothing answered, save the wind. It wasn't a mournful note like it was upon the tor. The wind in the wood was a chime, dissonant, discombobulating, flinging itself near and far. It reverberated through the trees, the leaves, the thorny vines that lay over the road. The wood suddenly felt tighter, the air closer, as if the spaces between the birch trees had narrowed. I looked up, studied them. Their pale bark wasn't translucent or papery, but mottled, heavy, like old flesh. And the knots in the trunks, gashes of darkness in all that pale, sloughing bark. The knots were eyes. Hundreds of black, lidless eyes, watching me. I jerked back, my hands, my feet scraping over thorns, scoring the road red. There was a noise, the groan of wooden wheels. Yellow light split the darkness. I blinked against it and saw that there was a cart on the road, drawn by a grey horse, coming toward me. Driving the cart was a man with a grey beard, stooped over the reins. Next to him, lantern light catching along the angles of his face, his black hair, the rings in his ear. Rory. When I looked back to the birch trees, they were eyeless once more. Just wood and bark and branches and leaves. I slipped into their gaping shadows. From between thorns, I watched the cart roll past. Then, whoa! The horse whickered a complaint, and the cart groaned to a halt. Go ahead, Victor. Rory's boots hit the ground. I'll be there shortly. The cart resumed its journey, but those boots stayed firmly in my line of sight, rocking back and forth onto their heels. Whoever you are who's bled onto the road, Rory called. I hope you're enjoying your night. When I stepped from my hiding place, Rory's eyes widened, roaming over my clothes and the blood upon them. What the fuck, Diviner? I touched my new shroud. Did you put this over my eyes? He blinked confoundedly, like he'd been thrown into a horse race with no horse. Did I? Yes, I put that there. I'd thought you'd... He shook himself. The wood is dangerous after dark. What the hell are you doing, bleeding out here in the middle of the night? He hissed out a sigh. And would you look at that? You're not wearing shoes. I've spoken to Benji. He told me what his grandfather knew, that there are no records of diviners after they leave the tor. That's why... I spoke too fast, rushing through the atrociousness of it all. The ardent oarsman bit me, because he's put his teeth in diviners before, lapped up their blood, their... I forced myself to say it. They're dead. Warmth fled his face, silence taking us in its fist. Rory did nothing to dispel it. Then, the artful brigand always wanted the spring water, but the rest... He was too anxious, too furious to even fidget, standing perfectly still. I didn't know. I was struggling to breathe, underwater, drowning all over again. The abbess never told us how the spring works, how the dreams come, but it's fearsome magic. When I divined for you, when the gargoyle drowned me, I didn't dream of the five omens. I dreamed of the sixth, the moth. The diviners vanished after that. I put my hand to my chest. Maybe I've known this entire time that something horrible had happened, that I'd never see them again. Rory shook his head. If the spring upon the Tor truly grants its dreamers signs, then it is cruel magic. Why show you something and give you no power to change it? There was nothing you could have done, Diviner. Rory cusped the nape of his neck. But you can do something now. Put the other omens down. Destroy Aisling. When I looked up, I saw fear in his eyes. Just don't give up. I can't keep going. Yes, you can. I felt the truth in all my bruised and broken skin. I always had strength, and ever just enough. Being a diviner, being one of six, I loved it and hated it and bore both so well. And now that it's all gone, a great agony pressed behind my eyes. Everything is too heavy. My vision blurred. Sorrow, I realized. That was the agony behind my eyes. Sorrow, who came like a shepherdess, leading a flock of tears. I wish I was still a girl, made special for dreaming upon the Tor. For the first time since before I could remember, I cried. It hurt more than drowning. Rory's hand moved from my neck and hovered just at my face, not touching the tears that fell from beneath my shroud, but guarding them against the breeze, as if they deserved their own tender pilgrimage down my cheeks. I'm sorry, he said. I'm sorry for the diviners. I'm sorry the people who best understood what you've endured were taken from you, and that so much of living without them feels like dying. But if you hadn't left that Tor... He said it with a deep familiarity, like he'd thought to say it a million times, and the thinking of it had worn down all the sharp edges of saying it aloud. I'd have come for you. I'd have killed or stolen, or done any ignoble thing to see you free of that place. You are more special than you realize. I don't even know your name. He drew in a breath. And I would do anything for you. I cried in front of him, and hated myself for it. But the tears were hurried, as though they'd waited lifetimes to come. I cried and cried, and then... I don't know why I did what I did next. Maybe because my darling 1, 2, and 3, and 4, and 5 were gone, and I had never learned their names. Maybe because the divination ceremony at Aisling meant something to me yet, or maybe I was merely forgetting my faith in dreams, in the omens, in faith itself. And maybe, in all the forgetting, I wanted to remember who had come before. I put my thumb in my mouth and bit down. A line drew between Rory's brows. Blood, hot and viscous, pooled around my canine teeth. I let out a pained exhale, held my hand out to him. He knew. He always seemed to open a door to himself the moment I needed somewhere to go. Rory brought my bloodied thumb to his lips and said what I'd said to him, to thousands of others from Aisling's spring. What name, with blood, would you give me? I put my thumb to his lips. My name is Sybil Delling. His face broke open, as if I'd taken my chisel to his derision and shattered it. Rory ran the grooves of my thumb over his crooked bottom teeth, over his tongue, taking my blood into his mouth like it was something holy. Crimson washed away. When Rory withdrew my thumb from his mouth, he pressed a kiss over it. How was it, saying it aloud after all this time? I wiped my tears with the back of my hand. Years in the making, and over in a moment. We walked back to Petula Hall together. The old man on the cart was parked in the drive, asleep on his perch. Next to the cart, a figure spoke to the horse, wagging a stone finger in the animal's face. The gargoyle. He startled when he saw us.
Where on earth did you come from, Bartholomew?
He cast his gaze over my shoulder, wrinkling his nose at the chiming wood.
Not in there, I hope. Such an unpleasant forest.
Rory approached the wagon, thumped it with an open palm, jolting the old man, Victor, awake. Lucky for her, this just arrived. I peered into the wagon. In a bed of hay, something lay still. A silver exoskeleton that caught the torchlight. My armor.
The breastplate, at least.
When Rory brushed an errant tear from my cheek, black hair fell over his brow.
First, you heal.
His gaze fell over my bandaged neck, and he frowned.
By the time the knighthood gets here, you should be ready to wear it.
The knighthood isn't here.
Some of us left in a rush to get out of the peaks. They'll be here soon. Until then,
he nodded back at the looming house. Get some rest.
No more late-night sojourns into the wood.
Agreed,
the gargoyle said, yawning.
You look quite a mess.
He took my arm, led me to the door. I looked over my shoulder at Rory, standing by the cart. His legs were planted, hands clasped behind his back, like a good soldier. Good night.
Good night, he murmured. Sybil.
Chapter 22. Feel, but cannot see. I did not leave my bed for days. I couldn't move without pain, and my mind was dark, violent. I imagined diviners, lying still like they once did on Ashling's chancel, only now their cheeks were wan with death. Omens loomed over them, fingers curling greedily over gossamer. When I slept, I dreamed of bodies broken apart, of wet, horrible sounds, of blood and flesh and bone. Then I'd wake, hoping, in the brief sliver between sleep and consciousness, that I was back in the diviner's cottage, in bed next to one. But she was gone. They all were. Awake or asleep, I felt sick. On the fourth day in bed, I became too overcome to cry, to eat. The gargoyle sat in my room and hummed to himself.
Would you like me to tell you a story? The one with the tragic beginning and the desolate, interminable middle?
I have no use for stories. My eyes grew unfocused behind my shroud. Tragedy and desolation are right here with me.
Yes.
He went back to humming to himself.
But I am here too, Bartholomew.
At midday, there was a gentle knock on my door. I heard Maud's voice on the other side.
What, Benji?
The king's tone was fraught. It's not our place to intrude upon her grief. She needs to eat.
If you treat her like she's fragile, Benji said pointedly, she'll start to think that of herself. Let her remain as she is. Strong and fearsome.
Rory didn't say anything. He just opened the door and came in. When he saw me lying motionless on the bed, his entire body went taut. I rolled onto my other side. Go away.
No.
Bartholomew is in the throes of despair.
The gargoyle kept on humming.
A rather undervalued state of being, if you ask me.
No one issued any questions. They scattered themselves around the room, like it was natural that they'd be there. The gargoyle asked the king for a sip of wine, then coughed into his cup, while Rory paced in front of the window and fidgeted with his coin, turning every minute or so to look at me. Maud sat on the bed. She rubbed my back, soothing my shoulders, running a hand over my hair, like I imagined a mother would do to a sick child. Anger is a fine weapon, diviner, she said, quiet enough so the others wouldn't hear. So long as you don't point it at yourself. Now, have some soup. Eventually, I did. Neither grief nor fury let go of me, but being tended by Maud and Rory and the gargoyle, even Benji, not simply because I was useful to them, but because they cared for me, tempered some of my sickness. I ate, slept. On the sixth day, I rose from my bed, putting all the transportive stories I'd told the diviners of things we'd do in the wild world of Traum away. The only story I told myself now was a hard-hearted tale of vengeance, of destruction. I'd find the faithful forester's lost chime, go to the cliffs of Belladine, kill the Heartsaw Weaver. Then I'd return to where it all began, the Tor, the cathedral upon it, and face the Abbess. Mother, I'd once thought her, back when I'd spent all my strength trying to please her. But she was not a mother. She was an insect, weaving false stories, feeding upon my pain, working Aisling's machine for her own glory, her own power, her own timelessness. No, she was not a mother. She was the sixth omen, the moth. And for what she'd done to me, to the other diviners, to Traum itself, I'd take the tools she'd given me. Then, with hammer, with chisel, I'd annihilate her. Petula Hall had been in Maud's family for centuries, the bower name prominent in the Chiming Wood. Indeed, Maud herself was the jewel of the wood, and I came to realize, as we traversed into the hamlet and the village within, that it wasn't always me or the gargoyle folk would stare upon, but her. Maud, whom they would offer their hands, calloused from wielding axes, in greeting. The air smelled different in the Chiming Wood than it had in the Fervent Peaks, or the Siege, or Corson Fair. Here, within the embrace of birch trees, where the houses were all made of pale wood, and every man, woman, and child wore charcoal around their eyes and an axe on their belts, the air smelled sharp, hinting of idleweed. Folk spoke under the banners depicting chimes, the words of the wood scrawled beneath, only the wind can say what is to come. Whenever the gargoyle and I passed, some were even bold enough to speak to us of portents, of the omens. I heard a terrible noise on the wind this morning. Was it a sign of bad things to come? A fine gale blew, and I felled a great tree, but its insides were rotten. Is the faithful forester trying to tell me something? What do you see behind your shroud when you look upon the wood? My only answer was silence. There was nothing to say. I'd become molten iron, hit so many times by everything that had happened since the king had come to Aisling Cathedral, that I no longer recognized myself. The ardent oarsman's bite had taken my faith, my obedience, clean out of me, and for the first time in my life I felt rage to be revered. Venomous vitriol that the story of the omens, of Aisling, of me, was a lie. Nothing felt holy anymore, except maybe the dead. The wood is so vast, I said, tripping over bramble as I walked with the others into the village. Where do we even begin to search for the forester's chime? There is a glen, Maud said. It's sacred, because some nitwit from the Eichel family claimed he saw the faithful forester there some decades ago, and the elders have used it as a place of meditation ever since. Rory spun his coin between deft fingers. That's where they have their ceremonies when a new king comes. Which means as soon as the knighthood gets here, we'll be permitted inside. Benji kicked rocks. Your king will be a useless spectacle for the wood's nobles, leaving the rest of you to search the glen for the faithful forester's stone chime. I wouldn't call you a useless spectacle, Rory said, throwing his arm over Benji's shoulder. Just a happy little distraction. He mussed the king's hair. You're getting good at it. Looking all doe-eyed, practically weeping reverence to the omens, Mr. Ever-Butter Visitor. The kingdom's finest actor, Maud offered.
Or her best liar, the gargoyle said pleasantly.
Benji's blue eyes shot to my face as if to say,
They don't know what it's like to have to perform. But you and I do. I was still angry at him for the secrets he'd kept about lost diviners. But I could see in his blue eyes how eager he was to find the stone objects, to take up the mantle and succeed where his grandfather had not, to prove his worth. I'd been like that not so long ago. Of all the faces I'd seen since I'd left the tour, I feared I saw my own in Benedict Castor's the most. It took effort, but I smiled at him. You bear it well. On the seventh day in the Chiming Wood, we received a falcon that the knights were near. On the eighth day, we came to the village to receive them. I sulked beneath a birch tree, picking yellow leaves off a branch, waiting. Across the square from me, leaned up against a tree next to Benjie and Maud, Rory spoke to a pair of woodsmen. He was listening to them, but, unnoticed by anyone else, his left hand had dipped into the nearest man's cloak. When he took it out, he was holding a pipe. He stuffed it into his own pocket, looked up, and winked at Maud, who eyed him with exasperation. Thief.
You're making a face at the knave, the gargoyle said, startling me.
He was playing with the fuzzy seeds of a dandelion, peering around me at Rory.
Why are you giving him the cold mouth?
It's the cold shoulder, gargoyle. He blinked.
What would he want with your shoulder?
What would he want with my mouth? Amazing how, even with a face entirely of stone, the gargoyle could admonish me with a single look. He'd been giving me that look for days now. Maud and Benjie too, though they'd taken to running like dogs who'd heard a high-pitched whistle every time Rory and I were in the same room. A frequency no one could hear, but we all felt. It had begun the night I told Rory my name. Maybe earlier, if I was being honest with myself. But I'd noticed it distinctly when he'd changed the bandage on my neck. He'd peeled old linen away with such poignant effort, you'd think he was removing my skin. One hand on my chin, the other on my shoulder, Rory had turned my head, tendering the teeth marks in my neck a pointed look. Well?
Getting better.
I'd smelled something sharp, then the sweet, aromatic scent of beeswax. Rory spread wax over the punctures the oarsman had left. I'd shivered when his thumb had grazed the hollow of my throat. Just a chime and a loomstone left, I'd said, and your king will have successfully taken up the mantle.
Couldn't have done it without you,
he'd murmured, eyes on his work. But then they'd lifted, darting over my mouth. His cheeks had gone red, and my heart had cantered, and I'd felt his do the same in the pulse of his thumb, two beats, arguing for dominance. Rory had dropped the linen, cursed.
I'll get more.
Left the room in a rush. And that was how it went. He'd change my bandages, applying balms and ointments and honey, and I'd hold so still I imagined myself carved of stone. But no matter Rory's precision or my stillness, we were always flushed and breathless by the end. I thought it would stop once I'd healed. But telling him my name, grieving in front of him, had changed something between us. It felt like a fever, looking at him. I was dizzy and thoughtless for it. The gargoyle tutted.
You two have been posturing long enough,
he shouted at Rory.
I say, Bartholomew, won't you come over here a moment?
What are you doing? I seethed. Rory's dark eyes swung my way. His throat hitched, and then he was coming over, looking bored, but for the telltale red in his cheeks.
Help you with something? For the sake of my sanity.
A dandelion seed flew up the gargoyle's nose. He leaned back, cried out, sneezed in Rory's face. I barked a laugh, and Rory shut his eyes.
That's why you called me over, to sneeze on me. 1,000 apologies. What was I saying? Ah, yes.
The gargoyle put a stone hand on my shoulder.
For the sake of my sanity, put Bartholomew out of her misery. Tell her you're in love with her.
Rory's eyes jerked open, brows locking in a scowl. Behind him, Benji and Maud, who were doing a poor job masking the fact that they were eavesdropping, let out a collective exhale that came out a wheeze.
In love with...
Oh, he was red now. Rory's hands lowered to his sides, gauntlets tinging as he fidgeted, his eyes narrowing over the gargoyle, then me. I choked on my own tongue and leveled a finger in the gargoyle's face. You can't just say things like that. It's horrifying. He tapped his stone chin.
Have I gotten it wrong?
Decidedly.
Oh dear.
His chest puffed.
Then it's you who's in love with him, is that it?
There was no knightly virtue vital enough to keep Maud from hiding her glee. She was quivering with it. Benji, slightly less so. His eyes were shifting between Rory to me in quick turns. Pith, no! Sweat pooled in my palms. Must you always make nothing into something? Again, he tapped his chin.
Was it nothing? That knock in the fervent peaks, Bartholomew?
He nodded at Rory.
He came to our door, and you disappeared for many hours. When you returned, you were wet and took off your tunic and threw blankets over yourself. I tried to sleep, but you were terribly annoying, breathing loudly, sighing and making little sounds and stirring in your bed.
I slapped a hand over his mouth. Maud gripped the king. I told you they were sneaking around. I knew it from that first night at Ashling when he came back and smoked an entire branch of idleweed that he was fucked, one way or another.
So I've gotten it right?
The gargoyle clapped.
How marvellous! Oh, look! The knighthood has arrived.
He sauntered off, humming, as if he hadn't just massacred my pride in the village square. Voices echoed. The chiming wood was a palette of green and white and yellow, grass and birch trees. But through it, down the brambly road, I could see flashes of purple, of silver, the king's banners, and the knights beneath them. I followed Maud and Benji on their way to greet them, knocking into Rory's shoulder. An entire branch of idleweed, I quipped.
Little sounds,
came his slow, mirthful reply. Back at Petula Hall, grey clouds swaddled the sun, lending the sky outside my window the same pallid quality as birch bark. Looks like rain for the ceremony. There was a bang, followed by an affronted shriek.
Careful of my toes, Bartholomew!
Feet shuffled in the corridor, and Maud grunted. Your toes are made of stone, you great lummox! The gargoyle shrieked again. I heard him storm off, and then Maud was in my doorway, winded, carrying an iron object. A breastplate. Is that yours? You'll be needing it for the ceremony in an hour. And since your squire has just stomped away, she grinned ear to ear, I get to put it on you. The maiden voyage of my breastplate onto my body did not take long. The straps were tightened and the clasps set. It felt strange to be held closely by something so heavy. I didn't know if my breathlessness was from bearing it or from loving it. It's beautiful. The greater the spectacle, the greater the illusion. Maud wrapped a knuckle on my breastplate. But sometimes I think the spectacle means something. I felt like I was 100 feet tall the first time I put on armor, like I could do anything. When I was older, I ordered Rory and Benji their first sets, watched them grow into them. And that meant something, too. My voice was small. I still can't pay for it, Maud.
Oh, the pride on you.
Her green eyes shone. Would you still wear it if I told you it was a gift? I looked down at myself. Maud had told me on the road to the Fervent Peaks that she didn't know anything about being maternal. And it heartened me that someone as honourable and purposeful as Maud Bower could still get some things wrong. She was the most nurturing woman I'd ever known. Yes.
Good.
She disappeared back down the corridor. When she returned, she held a wooden pallet with wet charcoal upon it. Now, let's get ourselves painted. She smeared the charcoal around her eyes the way I'd seen her wear it 100 times. Only this time, she did not stop at her eyes, drawing dark hollows over her cheeks, a dark triangle over her nose, lines over her lips. I watched, transfixed, like a painter's understudy. Why do folk of the wood wear it? Charcoal, I mean. Tradition, an old safety precaution. Because of the Bilka. What's the Bilka? A name we have here. Bilka, birch tree. I could tell she wasn't keen to talk about it. And... Maud sighed, making a face at her own reflection. They're called Bilka, because they look like the trees, only they aren't. They're sprites who prowl the wood. Once they fed on idleweed, but folk here keep it stored up for ceremonial or medicinal practices. Now, the Bilka feed on flesh. And what flesh they like best, she tapped her brow. Eyes. That's why we paint charcoal on our faces. The illusion of hollowed skulls, I know. It's garish, painting your eyes so they don't get eaten. But name me a tradition that isn't garish. I thought of the trees I'd seen my first night in the Chiming Wood, and was suddenly cold all over. When I dreamed of the faithful forester's stone chime, it was always in a circle of reaching birch trees. Only those trees moved, and their knots... I shuddered. Their knots were made of terrible blinking eyes. Are those... Indeed, Bilka. An hour later, when the sun had bid the clouds goodbye and surrendered to the moon, the knights arrived at Petula Hall. They waited outside, just as they had waited outside of the Diviner Cottage to escort us to Coulson Fair. Only now they weren't wearing full armour, just breastplates and the garb of the wood. Leathers. Cloaks. Their faces were painted like skulls. We were just finishing up painting the gargoyle's face. Maud had said it wasn't necessary, that Bilka had no interest in eyes made of stone, but the gargoyle had been offended to be so excluded, and so we painted him. When we were done, Maud applied a final dab of charcoal to my mouth and turned me toward the hallway looking glass. The effect of the charcoal was not so startling with my eyes hidden behind my shroud, but my brow, my cheeks, my jaw bore all the contours of a head without flesh. A skull, emptied out by shadow. I look like I'm dead, I murmured. And because everything did, that made me think of the diviners. Maud smiled at my reflection. You're perfect. We stepped outside into the courtyard. Benji was at the front of the line, talking to Hamelin and two other knights I recognized. Dedrick Lange, who hailed from the Siege, and Tori Bassett, from the cliffs of Belladine. Rory stood slightly apart from the others, arms crossed over his chest, taking in the sight of me in my new breastplate. I thought, having so often seen him with charcoal around his eyes, that the effect of the paint would not be so striking. I was wrong. Rory, black hair awry, rings in his ear, face painted like his skull, he looked as far from a knight as I dreamed a man could. He, like me, looked like death itself. Well, Six, Benji's arm was there. You're about to see me prostrate before man and God alike. Again. I sighed, took his arm. If I could draw the short straw and do it in your place, I probably would. The smell hit me before we reached the sacred glen. Sharp, pungent. Idleweed. It wafted through the trees, a mist that smelled so severe it put tears in my eyes and made the gargoyle cough. At the mouth of the glen, 5 hooded figures waited. Their cloaks were yellow, like birch leaves, their faces painted in the same skeletal design as the rest of ours. Like the esteemed families who waited at the fervent peaks, the nobles of the Chiming Wood fixed their gazes upon Benji. I am Eleanor Eichel, one of the hooded figures said, nodding at Maud. My family, like the Bowers, have lived in the Chiming Wood for hundreds of years. She was old, stooped, with a deep, croaking voice. You, new king, are another Benedict Castor. She paused a long while. Her painted eyes were hidden beneath the hood of her cloak. Still, I knew the moment they turned to me.
But I can see you are nothing like your unbelieving grandfather. It is an honor beyond all reckoning that you have brought a daughter of Ashling to our wood. A good portent, one of the other nobles said. I can feel it. A sign of great things to come from the faithful forester, another added.
Night fell, and it began to rain. We filed into the glen, where the rain did not touch us. The trees were too dense, some of the birches growing in such immediate proximity that animals had gotten caught and died between them. There were antlers, skulls, the grotesque remains of creatures long dead. Chimes hung from their bones. Above, leaves wove together, forming a yellow roof that did not let the rain through. It lent a dampness to the air, an oppressive closeness. We walked through trees, through smoke and gloom, and then I saw it. A dais, standing in the center of the glen. At its edges, pyres of idleweed smoldered. The noble elders gathered upon the dais, held out their hands to Benji. When he joined them, standing before us like an actor upon a stage, they removed his breastplate, pushed his shoulders down until he was kneeling before them.
It takes more than a strong arm and a sure axe to be a forester, one of the nobles called. You must consort with your senses, understanding your tree from its roots to the tips of its leaves before you fell it. You must know its place in the Chiming Wood, and intuit what its absence will bring. By touch, or sound, or smell, you must know what the bark is like before you cut into it. You must learn to feel.
The nobles ran their hands over nearby chimes, a discordant knell.
Only the wind will tell us what is to come, they murmured. We cannot see good portents, nor bad, another proclaimed. That is for the omens and their harbingers. But we can feel them, just as, with the sacred smoke of yellow idleweed, we feel the holy presence of the faithful forester among us. She is the song of the wind, near and far, hither and yon, felt but never seen. I'm about to pass my own wind if they don't wrap this up, the gargoyle muttered. For it is the omens who rule Traum, all five nobles said at once. Omens who scrawl the signs. We are but witnesses to their wonders, pupils of their portents.
They looked out over the knighthood.
Ever but visitors to their greatness.
Ever but visitors, Benji said.
Ever but visitors,
the knighthood echoed. I said nothing. A flint sparked, and more idleweed was lit. Orange light perforated the trees, painting the entire glen a hungry orange hue. Eleanor Eichel came onto the dais. In her hands was a velvet cushion with a grey object upon it. When she lifted it, my body seized. It was a chime. Not like the others in the glen, fashioned of wood or metal, this chime was stone, old and strange. I'd seen it thousands of times before, but only ever in my dreams.
Take it in, Eleanor Eichel said, scouring the crowd. Listen to the wind, to the voice of the faithful forester, sounding between the trees.
She lifted her hand, struck the chime.
and feel.
Chapter 23. The Chime. The ring of the chime was beautiful, steady, melodic, but it split into me like a chisel. Suddenly I was fissuring, my mind cracking open. The glen of tightly woven birch trees became a blurred visage, and my thoughts became unmoored. I was everywhere and everything at once. Foundling, diviner, Sybil, six. I danced around a pyre in Coulson Fair, climbed a mountainous path in Fervent Peaks, rushed through bustling streets of the Siege. Then, familiar noises echoing in the walls of my mind, footsteps on the stairs in the diviner's cottage, a young three and five laughing, a comb tugging through four's dark hair, one breathing long and low in her sleep, the bat-like gargoyle humming to me as I worked the wall. The chime stopped ringing, and I was jolted back to the sacred glen, my mind writing. But then, gods, it rang again. Only this time, the notes were not melodic. They were ugly, discordant, a horrible knell. Once again, my mind felt struck open. Only now it hurt, disorienting agony radiating from my temples. I heard the slosh of spring water, the abbess's voice, strange, special, and new. When I looked down at my body, my shiny new armor was covered in pale, fluttering moths. The chime stopped, and everything went quiet. My armor held no moths, just the reflection of licking flames. When I looked around for the gargoyle, or Rory, or Maud, the knighthood was not standing in a line as they had been. They were scattered among the trees, swaying on their feet. Some had their hands to their ears, others had their eyes shut, but all looked to be in a stupor. It was the chime, the faithful forester's chime. The magical stone objects, their abilities, transportive and destructive. The coin, the inkwell, the ore, those were all physical. But this, the chime, the sound of it, wasn't a flickering of my corporeal self. It was as if my thoughts had been transported. When the chime had rung harmoniously, my thoughts had gone with it, taking me to the joyous corners of my mind. But when it had rung discordantly, there was pain, fear, strange, special, and new. I coughed, smoke stinging my eyes. Meanwhile, upon the dais, the ceremony continued. Eleanor Eichel, bleary-eyed, had set down the stone chime and was holding a smouldering branch of idleweed out, like a torch. All the nobles were. They turned in predatory circles around Benji, wielding the branches, stirring the air, smoke ghosting behind them. The glen became blanketed by smoke. It put a lid over me, sedating my senses, burned my eyes. I faltered back a step. My spine collided with armor. "Have you smoked yellow idleweed before?" a voice said in my ear. It took me a moment to recognize Hamelin with his face painted. No. A noble with thin lips and gnarled knuckles bent low over Benji. His spine went rigid, but he did not resist. The noble inhaled idleweed smoke into her nose from her burning branch, seized Benji's face, and clamped her mouth over his. I let out a curt breath. When the noble let Benji go, imbuing him with smoke, the clarity in the king's blue eyes was already fading. "They only ever burn it like this when a new king comes for a ceremony," Hamelin murmured. "I've heard breathing it is like a fever dream. Your mind is thrown asunder. Prepare yourself for a treat." It's not just the idleweed, I thought. It's the chime.
All five nobles bent over Benji, filling him with smoke from their mouths. When they'd finished, the king was still on his knees, but he seemed unaware of it. He was swaying, as if he weighed too little, yet far too much. His eyes rolled back, and he began to hum in wretched harmony with the chimes. The nobles watched him, satisfaction stealing over their painted mouths. They turned and set their smoldering branches loose on the knighthood. The idleweed was passed from night to night, the process repeated. Not all partook. Those who did breathed in the smoke, pulled in a second breath, then pressed his or her mouth over another's, filling them with smoke like a tongue fills a mouth in an impassioned kiss. I thought of four, blowing idleweed into our mouths the night we visited Coulson Fair. How she'd told us of what life would be like away from the Tor, transporting us into the future. How, in a soft cloud of smoke, I'd promised her a world where we would always be together. How, without meaning to, I'd lied. Next to me, Hamelin held a branch of idleweed, breathed it into his nostrils, then turned to me. Take a deep breath. You'll like it. I shook my head. Hamelin's hand fell upon my shoulder. Come, diviner, be mythical, be fearsome, he said, echoing the words he'd said to me weeks ago, between kisses. He sucked more smoke into his nostrils, leaned his face toward mine, whispered, he's a dark horse, keeping you close. He tried to blow the smoke into my mouth, his lips practically on mine. I shoved him back, hard. He stumbled, as if the idleweed, and being twice denied by a diviner, had made him unsteady. Hamelin looked up with lifeless eyes, took a step toward me again, and was brought to a wrenching halt. Rory had his fellow knight by the face. He gripped Hamelin's cheeks, pressed brutally. Hamelin coughed out smoke, and Rory sneered at him, slapping the idleweed branch from his hand. Don't fucking touch her again. Hamelin's gaze darted from Rory to me, then to Benji in the distance, as if beseeching the king to put a leash on his knight. But Benji was on his knees upon the dais, swaying with shut eyes, leaving Hamelin no option but to lower his own. When Rory let go of him, he blurred away, disappearing into the glen, into smoke. I reached for Rory. It's the faithful forester's chime, I said. When it rang, did your mind... did you... Rory caught my arm and pulled me against him. Yes. He winced against the smoke. The idleweed isn't helping. Or maybe it is. No one suspects a magic chime is twisting their thoughts when there's this much smoke in the air. He reached to his belt, withdrew a small knife, then cut the hem of his tunic into two strips. He held one to his face, covering his nose and mouth, then handed me the other. This will help with the idleweed. That chime, however. Maud was suddenly there, and so was the gargoyle, their voices reverberating around me. She nodded at the dais. We need to snag that chime from Eleanor Eichel while the others are too distracted by the smoke to... The chime rang again, harmonious, the world blurred. My thoughts were as helpless as a gowan flower against a gale. I was suddenly a girl, back in Ashling Cathedral, spring water on my lips. The abbess was there, holding me, stroking hair from my eyes and tying a shroud around them. There, there, she murmured. Everything will be better for you now, little foundling. To sleep is to finally awaken. After all, swords and armor are nothing to stone. The chime stopped, and my vision righted. Eleanor Eichel stood next to Benji upon the dais, running her fingers over the faithful forester's chime, eyes rolling back in her head.
It came from this glen, this chime, she called into the haze. A gift from the omens,
just like the gold we've found over the years. Yes, yes, a gift from the forester. For whenever I strike the chime, I feel transported through time and space. I feel bliss and agony, just as the faithful must.
The other nobles in yellow cloaks stepped off the dais, moving slow and serpentine between birch trees.
Do you feel it? They called. Do you feel the divine?
All around, knights swayed, moving through tightly positioned trees. Whether they believed their thoughts had fallen prey to idleweed or something more sacred, it frightened me to see the kingdom's most commanding soldiers, like its king, so easily manipulated. Perhaps it was why the omens were so sure of their own transcendence. The faithful forester's chime, the stone objects, their magic, their power was astounding. Maud shook herself, her eyes red, but pointed firmly on the dais. I'll distract Eleanor Eichel. She caught Rory's arm. You, my thief, will snag that chime. Six, you and the gargoyle make sure Benji is all right. I lowered my hand, and the gargoyle took it, and we all headed for the dais. But just as we grew close, Eleanor Eichel lifted the faithful forester's chime once more and struck it. My vision spun. The chimes, so dissonant they sounded, like the notes within notes, rasping against one another. Against the walls of my head, where, in darkness, the abbess's voice waited. All your love and resentment and martyrdom were for nothing. I slapped my hands against my ears.
My mind is playing tricks on me, said the gargoyle at my side. What is magic? What is memory? And why are both so haunting?
It's the chime. My breathing was too fast. I pressed the cloth Rory had given me harder against my mouth. It's bringing me back to Ashling.
Me as well. I see craftsmen upon the tour, each holding a distinct stone object. Coin, inkwell, ore, chime, loomstone. I see Ashling, and I see dark, fetid water. I see blood.
The gargoyle began to tremble.
I see young girls wearing shrouds, and I watch them age. The ones that do not vanish fracture and bend and cry out. But like mine, their voices catch in the wind, distorting, then disappearing over the landscape.
I looked down at him. That sounds like my dream, gargoyle. The one I had of the moth. His stone eyes held me.
I imagine it does.
A sound perforated the wood. This time, it wasn't a chime. It was a scream. I stumbled. Did you hear that? There, coming from behind us, somewhere in the dark haze of the glen. More screams, followed by shouts. I put a bracing hand out to the nearest birch tree and felt it prickle. I turned. The tree's bark was laden with goose flesh. Only it wasn't bark. It was skin. And the knots in its trunk, gashes in all that pale, sloughing flesh, were eyes. I dropped the cloth I was holding and jerked back, yanking the gargoyle with me.
Bartholomew, what are you—
Shh! The tree, no, the bilka, watched us, horrifying and grotesque and utterly silent. And I thought, maybe, just this once, it was not such a terrible thing to be from Ashling. Because this sprite, this monster, took no interest in the gargoyle's stone eyes. And no matter how it searched for mine, it could not glimpse them behind my shroud. I heard the ring of swords, more shouts sounding.
Sprite attack!
The bilka beside me shifted, and I saw how large it was. Behemoth, rivaling the tallest tree in the glen. It lifted its roots from the earth, moving toward the heart of the glen, until it was looming over the dais, Benji and Eleanor Eichel still upon it. There were more sprites, I realized. The glen was full of pilka, every other birch tree seeming to move, the sacred glen morphing into something unholy. An ambush. A hunting ground. Visors lowered, protecting their eyes against the vicious swipes of the bilka's gnarled branches. The knights struck out against dozens of swiping bilka. Maud was at the lead.
"Don't let them see your eyes!" she cried,
swinging her axe to the sickening sound of flesh splitting, blood splattering. Then, more screams. They came from Eleanor Eichel. She was on the dais, holding tight to the faithful forester's chime and staring up at the behemoth bilka. Next to her, Benji, by fear or idleweed, was so incapacitated he couldn't even raise his head. He trembled, and Eleanor screamed. And the great bilka drew closer. It blinked its dozens of eyes and reached forward with branch-like limbs. Then, the pale surface of its flesh was opening, a hole peeling wide in the center of the bilka. No teeth, not tongue, just a dark, lipless mouth, and more eyes within. The gargoyle and I pushed forward on frantic feet, my hammer and chisel drawn.
"Benji!" I shouted. "Benji, move!"
He looked up, right into the bilka's dark mouth, and froze. The bilka made a horrible rasping call, and the king shut his eyes, quivered, and vanished. The bilka's branch-like fingers curled around Eleanor Eichel instead, and the faithful forester's chime fell, catching on one of the creature's branches. The bilka raised Eleanor, screaming from the dais, brought her to its wide, gaping mouth, and ate her whole. Benji reappeared 20 feet away, clasped tightly in Rory's arms. Hamelin and Dedrick Lange broke from the knights fighting more bilka, and Rory handed them the king. They hurried from the glen, retreating into smoke, and Rory vanished too, reappearing seconds later back on the dais. It took a moment for him to spot me in the mayhem, his eyes so dark and desperate, my heart stopped. I ran to him. Rory caught me around the waist, gripping me so tightly I lost my breath. I turned to the bilka. "We've got to get that chime." Rory weighed his coin in his palm. "Too high to throw." He turned it over, rough side up. But he didn't throw it, saying in a strained voice, "I don't want to kill it." "Why not? They're starving. All the sprites are. The knighthood makes sure of it. Even Maud." Turmoil lined his brow. "Hunger is a slow, maddening torture. If the sprites are monsters, it's because we've made them so." Behind us, the battle raged on. Bilka swung at the knights, opened their mouths and snapped at them, but the knights were far quicker with their blades. They cut the sprites down, and the birka shrieked, a wretched sound that put 1,000 prickles on my neck. Several fell. The rest retreated. The knights kept attacking. Meanwhile, the faithful forester's chime was still stuck high upon the behemoth bilka's branches. It turned, drawn by the clash of swords, and lumbered toward the knights. The gargoyle sighed.
"Very well, if you find the violence ignoble."
His voice was dry, but his finger trilled excitedly.
"Go ahead, ask me to be your pigeon."
Rory and I turned.
"You want to fly?"
"By the seat of my skirts."
He grasped my waist, smiled, then on mighty feet, the gargoyle sprang from the ground. His wings spread, beat the air, stirring smoke. I held to his neck and he to my waist, and then we were soaring.
"Seat of my pants!" I called over the wind.
He flew us to the top of the bilka, where the air was not so smoky. I took in gulping breaths, held my arm out. For each pass around the great beast, I tried to snag the faithful forester's chime off the fleshy branch it was lodged against. The birka aimed a few idle swats at us, but its attention was spent on the knights, leaving the gargoyle and I to keep circling. But no matter how I reached, I couldn't grasp the chime. On the next pass, I let go of the gargoyle's neck. Toss me. Oh, he was delighted, smiling so wide his fangs peeked over his lips.
Toss you?
I can't reach the chime. You're going to have to... I was already airborne. I collided with the birka a few hands below the chime, grasping the creature's mottled flesh, the effect so grotesque my stomach rolled. The gargoyle clapped and Rory swore from below. When my stomach was not in my throat, I clung tighter to the birka, swung my legs around it, and began to climb. Flesh and stone were nothing alike. Still, I managed, pretending I was back at Ashling, climbing its wall. I could hear the wet sounds of the creature's many moving eyes, feel the vile prickle of skin beneath my hands. Below, the crash of swords and the horrible sounds of sloughing flesh echoed, but I did not look down. All I held in my gaze was stone, the faithful forester's chime, closer, closer. But just as my finger closed around it, a low, horrible groan sounded. The birka trembled. Rory began to shout. When I looked down, a spring of blood was flowing from the birka. A fatal wound. The knighthood stepped back, but Maud remained, striking again and again with her axe, like she had something to prove, someone to save. The birka swayed. Rory kept shouting for her to stop, to retreat.
Maud!
She didn't heed him. Maud kept on swinging, and the birka kept on taking her blows, and I lost my grip. My fingers wrapped around the faithful forester's chime, and I fell, plummeting through air and smoke. Stone arms caught me, the gargoyle chuckling with glee.
All in a squire's duties.
Then we were soaring, wind scraping against my cheeks as we shot out of the trees and into the night. When I looked back at the sacred glen, the idleweed was burning low, illuminating the conquered sprites, who lay like fallen timber upon the earth. The last of them, the great behemoth birka, fell, the monster slain. But if the creature was a monster, it was because it was made that way. And maybe the birka knew that. Maybe knights and boy kings and diviners weren't the only creatures in the Traum who wanted to kill their tyrants. Because when the great birka succumbed to the axe, dropping like a felled tree in the forest, it took Maud with it. Chapter 24. Take Off My Armor. We put the faithful forester's chime in Benji's room with the other stone objects and shuttered Petula Hall. Not even the knighthood, dispatched to the village 2 miles away, was allowed in. And not just because their fellow knight Maud Bower was bruised and broken and unconscious. It was to spare them the sight of their king. Benji was, I didn't know what to call it. His grief that Maud, whom I expected he held as both mother and sister, was so injured, put a misery in him no ale or wine or idleweed could ease. No, he said, spilling his wine when Rory tried to drag him from her bedside for a proper sleep. I want to stay. It was 2 days after the ceremony in the sacred glen. Maud lay on a finely woven quilt atop her bed, covered in bandages. The birka had fallen on her, shattering the bones on the left side of her abdomen and putting a swollen knot along her temple. Her ribs, her shoulder, her arm and fingers, all broken. The village physician came and went, setting